I'm very pleased to welcome back to the Telpa Escape Podcast Series, Episode 7, Margot O'Byrne. Welcome back, Margot.
Thank you, Michael. Lovely to be back.
It is lovely to be back. Some of our avid listeners have been in touch saying, where is Episode 7? It seems to be a long time after Episode 6. But of course, there are ships at sea. There are things happening. There's Breslin and Desmond trying to get to Fremantle. I mean, it's really quite exciting. And just to remind ourselves, when was it that the Catalpa, with Captain Anthony at the helm, left New Bedford and started out on this great journey?
Oh, yes, it is a great journey, isn't it? So remember back in April, April the 29th, that Captain Anthony, that the Catalpa sailed out of New Bedford. So the planning had started before. Devoy met Anthony back in February. They had to buy the boat, then it sailed out. And then, of course, they had to go sailing in the North Atlantic for Wales.
Had to keep up the pretense, so to speak.
That's right.
They
keep the crew engaged.
The crew engaged. They lose some of them, all of those things that our avid listeners know. And then they sort of change course. And they're heading for Frio, or for Bunbury, perhaps. And then I met Captain Cousins on the Ocean Beauty in the Indian Ocean, south of Port Elizabeth, South Africa. When does that meeting take place?
Okay, that meeting took place in February, the 16th of February, south of Port Elizabeth. So it's a few hundred kilometres south, but direct south of Port Elizabeth in South Africa. At that stage, Breslin would have expected that the Catalpa would have arrived in Bunbury. It was due to arrive late January, early February of 1876. But in fact, after that time, there was a storm before they met Captain Cousins, and they were. But previous to that, they were becalmed for probably weeks there, south of South Africa.
Didn't lose their way, but they lost their time schedule, you might say.
Well, they lost the wind, Michael.
They lost the wind. It's a very important thing if you're a sailing ship. So, and at the conclusion of our last podcast, James Breslin, posing as Mr. Collins, had travelled from Melbourne to Albany, and he was boarding the steamer Georgette to come up to Fremantle. When does he actually get to Fremantle? What time are we talking to? It's about now, is it?
It's the 16th of November.
So he's there and intends to be there a reasonable time before, at that point, the expected arrival of the Catalpa in the January.
Correct. January, February,
Things happen, and we'll talk more about that. But the Georgette, just remind me, I mean, the Georgette figures and looms large in this story, Margot. What sort of boat is she?
I think it's good that we know. You know, we are the shipping news, so we have to pay a bit of attention to the ships. So the Georgette was a relatively new steam schooner that was playing quite a vital role in the whole trade in Western Australia. She was the mail ship and the passenger ship. And she took people from Champion Bay, which is in Geraldton, to Fremantle, onto Bunbury and to Albany. And my understanding is that it was about once a month that it would go to Albany, and then from Albany turn around, pick up the mail there. Because at that stage, Fremantle wasn't such a large port, because everyone had to anchor quite a way out in Gage Roads. So a lot of the shipping that came in from England actually came to Bunbury. Not to Bunbury, to Albany.
Yes, it's amazing. And Albany, of course, has a beautiful harbour, and still some people who think Albany should become the capital of Western Australia. It wouldn't have been much of any sort of boat building business in Western Australia then. There were people around Fremantle who did build smaller boats. But what about the Georgette? Where did she get built?
Okay, well, she came, like a lot of steamers at the time and after, she was built on the Clyde, in at Dunbarton in Scotland. by a firm called Macmillan and Company. She was iron-hulled. She had two masts and was a screw-driven schooner. So our listeners who are much more into the ships than I am will be aware of that.
But a steamer at the same time. She's producing the power to make the propeller work.
That's right. But so she had sails and was driven by steam, and it took me a while to actually get my head around that.
Well, things were changing in the world of a sail and mechanized movement in those days, I guess. And do you know anything about how long she was?
Yeah, she was 151 feet long and registered at 211 ton.
Now, with all that iron and sail plus sort of motor steamer, could you go fast?
No.
What?
Her
Really?
top speed
No.
was 4 knots.
Or not.
4 knots. And I
I could
think
swim faster than that.
that well, you can come into Fremantle Harbour faster than that now too. So she wasn't fast, but she was sturdy. And she could the thing about the Georgette was, and I guess this is why they purchased her, was that she could sail in all weather conditions. And that would be very necessary if you're sailing all year round around the southwest coast.
Sounds like she was well picked. She was a hard worker, no doubt. Do we know anything about the voyage that Breslin and/or Desmond, Collins and Johnson, as they alibi names operated, thought about the Georgette?
Oh yes, well Breslin described because they'd come over from Melbourne. They can't remember they'd come from San Francisco to Sydney. They'd come from Sydney to Melbourne, Melbourne across to Albany, and Breslin then described being on the Georgette as if he was being on as if he was on a donkey.
Well, Breslin, and do we think Desmond as well arrive on the Georgette at the same time into Fremantle on the 16th
Well,
of December?
that's my understanding, Michael, because when they left Sydney, Desmond went on ahead to Melbourne, and they were planning to travel separately, but the passage available from Melbourne to Albany must have been limited, so they ended up coming on the same ship to Albany, and of course, the Georgette only got into Albany once a month, so they would have had to come up on the same ship on the Georgette from Albany.
Now, our listeners will recall that Breslin must have been some charming guy. He turns up here and he's Mr. Collins. He's the big guy. We'll talk more about him in just a moment. And Desmond, he's not someone who Breslin come Collins would spend any time talking to. He's a worker, he's a carriage builder, whatever. And they arrive in Fremantle. Paint the picture for us all about what Fremantle looked like then. We have to remember at the very outset that, of course, the 1890s hadn't arrived, gold hadn't been discovered, and all the beautiful gold rush buildings that currently populate and make Fremantle downtown famous weren't there.
No, they weren't. So Fremantle was a settlement, really. It wasn't even, really a town. And Breslin was a bit surprised by this when he arrived. There were approximately 3,000 people living here. He said that many of the buildings were small wooden shops, shacks, cottages, and there were a few double-storied residences being of the more wealthy folk. And the only substantial buildings of sandstone in in Fremantle were the government constructions. So one of them would have been the what's now the Shipwreck Gallery. That was there, and that was the when the convicts arrived. That was where, of course, the store where all the convicts got their uniforms and so on. And there would have been others like that. He said they were nearly everything was covered in dull whitewash, which was reflecting the glare of the Australian sunshine.
Well, the so-called the establishment, what we call Fremantle Prison today, must have loomed large over all of that.
Yes, it's hard to imagine that it must have been the most imposing thing in Fremantle at the time. And it sat up there like a big monolith, and must have been quite a menacing situation for Breslin to arrive and see just how large and how threatening this establishment really was.
and how small it was, and he has to organise the escape of six Fenians. Fascinating. So what does Collins, let's take them one by one, what does Collins do when he arrives?
So Collins, clearly they get off the ship. They haven't communicated with each other on the Georgette. Collins, I believe, walked to Perth, like many people would have done in those days. And he very quickly found work as a carriage builder.
You mean Johnson?
Sorry, Johnson. Sorry, I apologise, Johnson. Collins, of course. Collins was he was he ordered the far, the fanciest carriage, and took himself first to Perth, actually, to investigate that. Found Perth was a much bigger town of 6,000 people, but decided that he would be better off coming back and taking a room in Fremantle.
And we know where he stayed, don't we?
We do. He stayed at the Emerald Isle Hotel, which is on the corner of High Street and Henry Street, which is, of course, the site of the present-day Orient Hotel.
Which is busily just closing down that part of
Sadly,
the
yes.
very sadly. But isn't that wonderful, that Irish connection, the Emerald Isle? And going back to Johnson, what does he do?
Okay, so Johnson, as I said, walked up to Perth. Found work as a carriage maker, which was of course his trade, and he pretty much blended into the working class in the colony at the time.
So at this point, I think Mr. Collins, Breslin, was what, in his early 40s?
He was actually in his 30s.
Still in his 30s. So both of them are young men around town, so to speak. Now, things were starting to happen in Western Australia in a way. It's starting to settle into being a colony. It's got its convicts. It's got its Fenians. Were there things happening that would make it, if you like, natural for someone like Breslin to be in town and be showing his wares?
Well, there was a lot going on. So, first of all, in the very week that Breslin arrived was the week that Ernest Giles arrived from South Australia. That was the first overland, successful overland expedition of the continent. So you can imagine in Perth, all the excitement. He arrived in New Norcia, and I can just imagine that the whole of the colony was heading up to Perth to, wave their flags and welcome him and his Afghan cameleers and Aboriginal guides, including Tommy Oldham, and to bring them into Perth and to feel that they was, at last connected to the rest of Australia. And Breslin, of course, Mr. Collins soon became the very big man about town. He was incredibly well dressed. He was such a gentleman. He was so charming, and he had so much wealth. And of
How
course, he.
do we know he had so much wealth?
Well, it was clearly a good actor, Michael. And of course, he had this note. Remember when he left San Francisco, Judge Cloney gave him a line of credit, or a so-called line of credit, for $100,000.
Oh my
Now,
goodness.
I mean, even today, a line of credit for $100,000 would get you a long way, but certainly then it would.
And particularly if you let that little document sit around on the bedside table in your room for someone to glance at and then spread the rumour.
Well, and Breslin believes that his reputation actually was enhanced by the fact that he did leave that note in the hotel room.
So, do we have any understanding from Breslin about how he found Fremantle and Perth as a community? Did he think he'd arrived in sort of somewhere in Ireland where, class structures were just the same, or somewhere in England or the US? Did he think he was in some new egalitarian place and this was going to make it easier to break the Fenians out? Do we have some understanding of what sort of society he was encountering?
Yeah, well, he soon realised. Remember, he'd spent many years in Boston, which in those days was pretty much the pivotal point of intellectual exchange and a real melting pot of ideas of liberty. And he'd come here and he described it as a relatively small class-driven community. And he soon realised that it would not be feasible for him to make direct contact with the Fenians because it just wouldn't have been something that would have happened for a man of his status and class and wealth to be seen talking to convicts.
So, who were the sorts of people he then decided he shouldn't mingle with in a relatively small community?
Well, he mingled with the best of them, including the Compiter General of the prison, Fauntleroy, and also eventually with the Governor of Western Australia.
It's amazing, isn't it? So he's staying down at the Emerald Isle, but he knows he has to somehow or the other get word to the convicts that he's here, and to lift their spirits, and no doubt to say, don't go and tell the Comptroller General Fauntleroy about this, or you won't get out. How does he set about making that contact and starting to think about how to break them out?
Well, fortunately, the proprietor of the Emerald Isle, Patrick Maloney, and remember he was told about the Emerald Isle back in San Francisco by Keneally and others. Maloney was originally from County Clare, and he was one of the trustees of the prison fund set up to assist the pardoned civilian Fenians. So he would have been well known in the Fenian circles, and we believe that he's the person who introduced Breslin to Will Foley. Now,
Who, remind us all, who was Will Foley?
okay, so our devoted listeners will remember a couple of episodes back when we talked about the various Fenians. Will Foley was originally from County Waterford. He was a military Fenian, but he'd completed his sentence, I think. From memory, his sentence was 5 years, but he was unable to leave the colony here because of ill health and lack of funds.
He wasn't banished forever.
No, he'd been released 2 years earlier from the prison, and once Breslin spoke to him, it was clear that Will Foley would be the man. Now, if we remember, Will Foley was the former personal messenger of the British General Rose. So he was well used to being operating in those circles.
Well, he must have been an impressive individual that presumably meant everybody liked him and trusted him.
Yeah, so Foley had complete access to Fremantle Prison. It was trusted by both the guards and the prisoners. So that was it was very lucky for Breslin that he had Foley, really.
The local, the Comptroller General thinks he's okay. The governor presumably thinks he's okay. The governor at this point was, I think, Robinson.
Yes, that's right.
The
Who
governor.
was of Irish descent himself? Well, he was really the upper class in aristocracy, the English Irish.
Well, the Irish Catholics populated Australia from the beginning. It looks like there were a few working as warders in the prison as well.
There were. In fact, the principal warder, Thomas Davies, was an Irish Catholic, and so was James McMahon, his assistant. And they certainly weren't Fenians, but they had a natural sympathy for the Irish cause.
Well, you'd hope so. So Foley's the man. I mean, how lucky to meet him. You'd heard about him, had that sense. You knew about the he had to go to the Emerald Isle. But what then happens? Does he make his own break into the establishment, Collins?
Yes. Well, first of all, he meets William Fauntleroy, the Compiter General of the Fremantle Prison, and the two of them just got on incredibly well, because Fremantle didn't get many gentlemen, and you can imagine that these upper class, very important, well, they had very important positions, and in England they would have been very much in the hierarchy, in the social hierarchy. So to meet someone that you could talk to about things, and so he was very happy to make the acquaintance of Mr. Collins.
Well, they've got these Fenians here. Is there some sense that they needed to have them locked down in sort of constant security, not allowed out of the prison? Are they expecting somebody to turn up and try and free them?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that, Michael, because Governor Robinson had actually had communication from Lord Carnarvon in London, some correspondence that suggested that intelligence had told them that there was money being collected in England and in Ireland to rescue the Fenians. But somehow Robinson and Fauntleroy together decided that they didn't want to alert anyone because that might filter through and then, these so-called spies or whatever it were that were coming might get word of it. So they would just keep it to themselves, and that as soon as these people arrived from England, they would arrest them. Now, for some reason, it never seemed to occur to them that there would be an American connection and that the Americans might try to be doing this as well.
Well, I mean, there's so much going on in Western Australia by this time. You've got Eunorsia that you've mentioned. You've got the famous Bishop Salvado has come back from Spain. You've got Catholics here and there. You've got nuns. The place is quite a hub of activity. And then you've got Fauntleroy meeting Collins. Does Collins sort of get his own map like he did from Captain Cousins of the prison, so he knows where to smuggle them out?
Okay, well, again, our long-term listeners will remember that Collins, who's Breslin, had previously worked in a prison. He had worked in Richmond Prison in Dublin, and in fact, he had been the person responsible for the escape of James Stephens, who was the head of the Fenian movement. And when Breslin went to work in Richmond Prison, he was interested in prison reform. He was looking at better ways for prisons to work and to rehabilitate prisoners and so on. So it was, you can imagine that he would have come along here. Fauntleroy organised for him to take a tour of the prison and be accompanied by the superintendent, Joseph Doonan. And the superintendent was absolutely charmed by Collins because he said it was so rare to be in the presence of someone who had a genuine interest in what he was doing. So he took Collins into the prison and they went through all the floors. They went past every cell, through the chapel, the punishment cells, the hospital, the cookhouse, everywhere. So this was just, I mean, Collins must have just, laughed his sides off when he got home that
Well, we know from earlier episodes you've told us that Devoy knew that Breslin was his man. He must have been the super smooth Irishman of all time and played the role to perfection. I mean, presumably he's a good Catholic. Does he go to church and do all the right things?
Yes, he does. Well, in those days, you very much kept to what your religion was. So he went down to the Catholic Church in Adelaide Street. I don't think it was the basilica that it is today, but it was certainly the local church, and the entire congregation came to know him, and they spoke of him as a man of independent means, touring the world in a leisurely fashion, idling a month or two here and there. But it would never have been appropriate. While he could talk to the parishioners in the church and to the local priest, and to Foley, he really couldn't have gone and had conversations with convicts.
No, impossible. Well, it'd be too dangerous. But he could have conversations with others he met along the line. There's a rumor around the place that he met a lady.
Oh, he did. So the rumour goes, Michael, and the lady was a chambermaid at the Emerald Isle Hotel, Mary Tonduit. And she was a French extraction, we think. And clearly they, became friends. He doesn't appear to have had a classist attitude at all, Breslin. So he would have struck up, first of all, a friendship with Mary, but which later turns into a lot more.
Well, we've got our listeners really, really engaged in the podcast now. We've got a love interest. Let's see what comes of it later. But what about the political military Fenians who are languishing somewhere in the establishment or out and about? Do they get to here directly? What happens?
Well, we remember if again, we remember from previous episodes that it was Wilson, James Wilson, the Fenian military prisoner who's in Fremantle Prison, who wrote the original letter to James Devoy, sort of talking about being a we are voices from the tomb. Yeah. So imagine what he felt that day. So William Foley goes up to the prison, he gets to talk to Wilson, and the conversation would have had to be brief because he's telling, Wilson wouldn't have been able to take much time off work. But he says to Wilson that the message, that his letter to Devoy has brought about arrest, someone into Fremantle who has come to enact the rescue.
Well, I can't imagine. And then, one way or the other, you could probably act this out in various forms. The word gets around, and no doubt, mum is the word.
Absolutely. So, not a word. And remember, these were military men. They were used to discipline, and they were used to, as a secret Fenian society, they knew that what it would mean to spill the beans and to talk loosely. And they also, many of them were in prison because of people who betrayed them. So they would have known very well that if you wanted to pull off an escape, that you needed to keep totally quiet and retain discipline and also be on their best behaviour.
Now, from what you said earlier on, of course, Mr. Collins, Breslin, is hoping, expecting that the Catalpa will turn up in about January. Here we are, middle of November. It's taken some weeks to meet everybody and be invited up to the prison and to meet Fauntleroy and to be taken around and get a sense of the place, and presumably that it's a pretty well-run place and not easy to break out of. But it's hot. We know, thunderstorms today in Fremantle. It'll be 39 or something tomorrow. Who knows? Must have been a little bit challenging for Mr. Collins. What does he do? What does he get up to? How does he? I mean, he didn't have an email or an internet to. He probably could sit down and read books. He could take Mary Tondat on long walks around around the river down to South Beach. But what else did he do? How did he keep up this front?
I suspect their relationship was a lot more clandestine than that, Michael. So he spent the hot summer days out and about in the colony. Remember, he'd come as an investor. So what he needed to do was keep up this charade that here he was going. So he got a horse and trap that he got from Henry Elbert's stable in Fremantle. And then he travelled to York, to Toojay, to Bunbury, to Perth. And on a couple of occasions, he dropped into Sloane's carriage factory in Murray Street, where the Yankee, Thomas Johnson, not known to Mr. Collins, of course, could be seen tightening the nuts and the axles on the axles in the carriage. And it was considered that Mr. Collins was clearly a man on a mission because he was looking to invest everywhere in major projects, wool, timber, and perhaps even gold.
Well, there's a wonderful report I can tell you. I'll share it with you. It's on the Fremantle Shipping News. Governor Weld's report, just before he finished his term, a couple of years before these events happened, he sent Lord Carnarvon a report on all the mineral and other resources in Western Australia. It was a place thought to be the future, like it is today,
Yeah.
Marco. So, by early January, do we have some sense of where Breslin was with his plans? I mean, had he given up the idea of trying to break him out of the prison? How did he think it was going to be done? How was he going to get him onto the Catalpa?
Okay, so he'd by January he'd had several interviews with Wilson. So so part of Foley's go-between was to actually plan for Breslin to meet up with Wilson. Of course, it would have to be, when there was a particular warder on and in a particular place. So Breslin did make this meeting with Wilson, and he told him that there was a whaler on its way and that it should be in Bunbury within the next month. That if the plan was going to succeed, they would need total cooperation of the Fenians. And it was very important that they all behaved well and continued to be allowed to work outside of the prison, because Breslin, from his travel tour through the prison, realized that it was be impossible to rescue them if they were locked away. So when the
Well,
time, sorry, when the time came, Breslin advised that he would take them to the beach, where there'd be a longboat manned by sailors, and those sailors would row them out to the whaler, which would be lying further afield in international waters.
it all sounds so totally unrealistic, doesn't it? To say, you
If
know.
you're desperate and locked in Fremantle Prison, I thought you'd be prepared to believe anything.
But you have to get half a dozen Fenians plus those supporting you about 20 miles down the track from Fremantle, where there's an American whaler just off in international waters, and spirit them away. What did Wilson think? Did he have plans? He's the man on the ground, and he must have thought this out.
Yes, well, he thought, because he was the one who sowed the seed that a whaler would be the way for them to escape. So he said that Breslin needed to get them six fast horses for the Fenians to get away on, but Breslin said no, that would just arouse far too much suspicion. To be able to hire that many horses, why did he need them? Who were they for? That kind of thing. So Breslin suggested that there would be two traps, little sulkies, and they would be just a one horse trap, and that the Fenians would be put in the back of the trap and driven away by Breslin and Desmond.
Starting to remind me of the days when I was at boarding school, and a group of us would get up in the dead of night and head on downtown to the local burger place, Margot.
Oh yes, I was at boarding school too, Michael. I know those midnight feasts that we had.
Now, these weren't, I don't think, the only six Fenians who we've constantly identified who were in the establishment. There were others. I mean, were some people aware of this, or might there have been others included in the escape who unfortunately
Yes.
didn't make it?
Well, in Wilson's letter to Devoy back in 1874, a year earlier, he had included a man called James Keeley. And Keeley was one of the life sentence Fenians named in the letter. However, since then, since the letter had been written, Keeley had become close to Governor to Compte General Fauntleroy. And he was working for him and his family as a personal servant. Now, success of this mission depended on absolute secrecy, and the Fenians just felt that Keeley couldn't quite be trusted to keep the secret.
His life
So they
was on
had,
the up and up, and he perhaps, and
well, I think because he becomes so close to Fauntleroy, then I think it was a bit of an us and them sort of situation, which often develops in groups. And Keeley, they took the very difficult decision that he would be left out.
it's tough, isn't it? Because everybody's human, and people have their own sort of personality traits and personal problems. Is there anyone else who sort of missed out on the list?
Well, there was another man called Thomas Delaney, but Thomas Delaney had actually been freed from Fremantle Prison, but was back in there because of public drunkenness.
Oh, golly, drank too much.
Yeah, so they
You
couldn't risk
wouldn't want
killing
to be
him either.
relying on him, would you? You wouldn't want to be relying on him.
No, because and that he would have, one if he could embrace sobriety, then he would have been freed from prison anyway. So it wasn't as if it like the military Fenians, he would never be let free.
Now, Foley, Will Foley, who we've already spoken about, he served his sentence. He was in a sense free to go, in every sense free to go. He was helping everyone out. Everybody trusted him. I mean, he didn't need to be put on the catalpa. I suppose he could have asked if he could have a way out. That would save his problems if he didn't have the money for the fare. What happened with Foley?
Okay, well, the absolute detail of it isn't written, but this is what I've put together. So in mid-January, Foley he was quite ill. He had a heart complaint, and funds were collected here, and no doubt Breslin contributed for the passage for Will Foley to go to leave Western Australia. And what he did was he made his way to Liverpool, and from there took a boat to Dublin. When he got to Dublin, he reported to the Irish Republican Brotherhood, what was transpiring in Fremantle. And when you think about it, no one would have sent a letter with all of this information anywhere in the British postal system. It just wouldn't have happened. So I believe that it was actually Breslin who said to Foley, "I need you to go and you're being the go-between for me here. You've proved your worth. Go and tell the IRB in Dublin what's happening. And then I want you to take a ship to New York, and I want you to make contact with John Devoy."
Well, that's amazing. If you don't have Foley there, he does take off, does he?
He does. He takes off and he does all of this. In Ireland, he goes to Dublin. He reports to the Irish Republican Brotherhood. He takes one day to go off and visit his family and then returns to Dublin and then immediately gets on the boat to New York. So that suggests to me that he was a man on a mission.
And this is before the Catawba escape had actually happened.
This is before the Catawba escape.
Well, if he'd been the main guy doing all of the inside work, if you like, carrying the messages, warming up the military Fenians for the escape day, how did those communications happen after he left?
Well, according to Peter Fitzsimons in his book, he says that it was Foley who introduced Breslin then to a teacher, Elizabeth McCann. Now, she would have perhaps been teaching the children of the warders and the prison guards, and it was she who then passed on messages through a friendly officer.
All right, so towards the end of January, Breslin, everybody's on tenterhooks in a sense. They're expecting the Catawba to turn up at any time. There are no telexes, there are no telegrams, there's no email, there's no iPhone 16 telephone calls to say where they are in the Indian Ocean. They're waiting. I imagine poor old Breslin really was on tenterhooks. He had money, presumably spending it freely, and he's very lucky to have Mary to keep him calm. But what was he up to?
Okay, so each time he would go on these trips around the colony, return, walk up and down each day to the telegraph office, which was outside, and there was a notice board outside the telegraph office, which is the present day site of the Buffalo Club on High Street. And he'd check the boards to see the shipping arrivals.
I do that every
Looking
morning and on
every
Fremantle
morning.
ports
That's
online.
right. Well, you can think of Breslin when you go and do it tomorrow, Michael.
So he's checking, he's hoping that there's some news because if the Catawba did tie up in Bunbury, word would come through quickly to Fremantle.
The notices, as I understand, were all, this ship arrived in Bunbury, this ship left Bunbury, this ship arrived in Fremantle, Champion Bay, where, wherever, Albany.
And then he has to make sure, hope, have his fingers crossed, and going to mass on Sundays and praying hard that the prisoners didn't get sent to York or to Jay or Champion Bay or somewhere.
Exactly, because that would then they would have been left behind, whoever was sent.
Now there's a guy we haven't mentioned today, John King, who we met in Sydney. Remind our listeners about John King and he wanted to be part of the action, didn't he?
Yes, well, if we remember that episode back in when Breslin arrived in Sydney and he'd met up with John King, again, this was he was put in contact with him through the Fenians that were who were in California. And King actually had his own plan of bringing the Fenians, helping them to escape. So they had that plan to take them to the French colony in the Pacific. And so when he, of course, met Breslin, he turned over, he realized what Breslin's plan was well formed and turned over the money there. And then he promised Breslin that he would go and collect, he and another operative would go and collect money from all of the Irish people in Queensland, in New South Wales, Victoria, and New Zealand.
And New Zealand. Amazing. The Irish were really a committed group. So his plan was to do what? Bring
Well,
the loot.
King was Breslin had organised with King for him to collect money and to be here in Fremantle, possibly in early February, because that's when he thought he would need it. So King left. He booked a passage on a to Melbourne first, then booked on the P&O mail ship China for Albany under the name of Jones.
Ah,
Very
so he has an alias. He has a person, a new personality.
He
And
does indeed. And he had a Gladstone bag full of gold,
gold.
$7,000.
Oh my goodness. You mean in the value of the day?
The value of the day, $7,000, would have been quite a lot.
Oh my goodness, in a Gladstone bag.
Yeah.
What's happened to Gladstone bags? I had one once when I went to boarding school. So does he get out of Melbourne easily and get to Perth,
Well,
Fremantle?
he gets out of Melbourne, okay, but unfortunately, when he arrives in Albany, word comes down that there had been an outbreak of a case of measles, and so they quarantined all of the passengers from the ship China onto Rabbit Island, in King George Sound, and so he was going to be stuck there on the island. And he thought, no, the Georgette will be here tomorrow. I have to get out of Albany. I have to get on the Georgette and back up to Fremantle because Breslin's waiting for me. He's dependent upon this money.
And not lose the gold.
Not lose the goal. Well, actually, Michael, he very nearly did lose the goal because at one stage the authorities came on and said, we're going to fumigate all of the passengers' luggage. And King was petrified. So what he did.
Did not want to open the Gladstone bag.
No, do not, and don't feel how heavy it is. And so he took his own Gladstone bag and threw it into the bush. And when the authorities asked him, he said, "Oh no, my luggage is already gone for fumigation." And then, of course, when it came back, he retrieved the bag, and then he had to get himself off the island and across to where the Georgette was tied up. So, being a organizer that he was, he started this rumor amongst the passengers and said, "This is ridiculous that we're being kept on this island for weeks when there was just a simple case of measles in Melbourne and none of us are infected." Now, we know this, having been through a pandemic ourselves.
And he's pointing across the Albany Harbour saying, there's the Georgette.
That's right, I'm going to be on there.
Only leaves once a month.
Unfortunately, there was a whale boat on the island, so he'd managed to convince, and all of the passengers, of course, agreed with him. But when push came to shove, there were only two that were actually willing to make the break with him. So that night, they took the whale boat and rowed across. It was about 4 miles, I think, across to where the Georgette was tied up, and they made it onto the Georgette. And fortunately for him, one of his companions on this whale boat knew the captain, and the captain agreed to take them on board.
Oh my goodness. I'm thinking there needs to be a slight variation in the plot line when we make the movie, Margot, because he doesn't throw the Gladstone bag with the gold into the bush. It slips and falls into the harbour, and then they have to dive for it. And at the last moment, they succeed in getting it and recovering it and taking it on board the Georgette.
Well, this story just keeps giving, Michael.
Georgette travelling at four knots. My goodness. So what happens? He makes it to
He
Freya.
makes it, he gets on board the Georgette, and they sail off the very next morning to Fremantle to meet Breslin.
Well, Margot, I haven't had such a lovely hour in ages talking about anything, and this has been such an illuminating story today, because it brings you face to face with Fremantle as it was, in a sense, as it is, and you've got all this human drama happening. And in the next episode 8, we're going to hear much more about it.
Oh, the drama just picks up. So seat belts on, folks. We're going to have more drama coming.
See you then, Margot.
Thank you, Michael.